Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across the planet, and anyone else who cares or dares to listen. Yes, this is indeed your navigator, John Lash, once again recording, this time on the 13th of March 2014, Nav Briefing number 114, and this is titled, The Advantage Given to Truth. So, I want to say that I hadn't anticipated the lapse since my last briefing. I believe that you heard me state my intention that I wanted to keep a good, strong, rigorous rhythm in the briefings up until the moment of correction, or until the time window of correction, the shift from reset to correction between the 19th and the 23rd of this month. Well, I've been overwhelmed would be an understatement. The tension at moments has been truly excruciating and continues to be. I probably said that in my introduction to the previous briefing, but it's only gotten more extreme over the last couple of weeks. And there are so many things pending right now in my life, existentially, materially, etc., in addition to the tremendous momentum that has been generated by our experiment together. Well, put that all together, and I can assure you that you have one very intensely preoccupied navigator. But I haven't been so preoccupied that I have forgotten my intention or forgotten any of you at any moment. I know that you're relying on hearing my briefings, as you always do, but that your reliance assumes a particular acuity now as we count down the final days until correction begins. Now, I may come across as just a little disordered or scattered in this briefing because I wish to cover some loose ends and pick up on some points that have been left in what I consider to be an unclear state. So I want to clarify some things I've said, dismiss a few things, correct a couple of key statements that I made, and cover a variety of subjects in the course of this briefing. Nevertheless, there is one focal theme for this briefing. There is one extremely crucial focal idea that I shall be transmitting to you. And so be assured that as discursive or digressive as the briefing may seem for the greater part of it, we're going to come together to an orchestral unity of understanding of what we have actually done in the GNE, this magnificent experiment. And that understanding will extend as well to the forward view that we may all hold in unison as this experiment moves out of reset and into correction. There are two things going back quite a ways in the briefings which have been nagging me for a while, and I'd like to correct them right off the top. You may recall I was once describing a nautical situation of looking at the lightship, which is the planet Saturn. And I described it as seeing a boat out in the waters removed some distance from the mothership, which it actually is, and that is a boat that has a lighthouse on it, and which is actually the case. that is what a lightship is. It is a portable lighthouse. So there is Saturn, we have designated as the lightship. Jupiter, we designated as the tug, as it were. The correction of the Aeon Sophia takes place in the apsides of Jupiter. And Mars, roughly and loosely, as the warship or gunboat. So this is all in the frame of the nautical metaphor of the GNE. Now, when I described seeing the lightship appear off the starboard, no, off the port side of the mothership, I believe it was, I said that it was in a mist and that I couldn't see the name of the ship that was written on the bow, on each side of the bow, and also across the stern. And as the mist separated and the ocean air became clear under the night sky, I picked out the name of the lightship, and it was called Arya, A-R-Y-A. You know, that is an ancient word of Sanskrit derivation that refers to nobility. It means noble. So the Aryan peoples were, by designation, noble peoples. And I proposed that Arya represents the ideal of true nobility for the human species, right? Okay. You can hold on to that idea if you like, and it is a beautiful idea. Well, it does restore the original meaning to the word Arya. However, I have come to reflect long and hard over that term, Arya, and I find, even though I resonate to it very strongly, and I consider myself to be thus an Aryan, that is to say, a particular member of the tribes of the earth, of the families of the earth, who is dedicated to realize and express the true nobility of humanity. If you are dedicated to that ideal or aim, then you are Arya. You belong to Arya, and you are an Aryan, whether you be a Japanese, a Swedish, of Swedish nationality, of Native American Indian, Brazilian, German, Spanish, whatever. All nationalities and races and cultures can equally aspire to belong to the company of Arya, of nobility. So I'm not retracting that term, but I would like to propose another term for the lightship. And that would be also a Greek word, A-R-E-T-E, which is arete, I believe, or arete, or arete. I don't know how to pronounce these Greek words. In fact, no scholar actually knows how they were pronounced in ancient times. But there is a conventional way to pronounce arete, I suppose. That is the word that is a Greek Sanskrit root, also begins with A-R, interestingly, and it means excellence. So let's just say, I don't know, it's kind of fudges the metaphor to say that the lightship has two names, you know. So I want you to consider that the name of the lightship is Arete, meaning excellence. The reason why I say that is because we are right now on the verge of correction. Also, on the verge, here in Europe where I live most of the time, of a massive political, cultural shift, and a shift of public opinion and a shift of public sentiment. And that massive shift is going back sharply to the right, and to the right wing, and to the right wing nationalist movements. Now, I think this is an excellent shift. Maybe we'll finally get the story of the Nazis rewritten to correspond more to who they actually were, how they actually behaved, and what was their agenda. but they were certainly a party, a political party, that had, in some respects, the ideal of Arya guiding them. And the problem, however, is that it is contaminated with the elements of racism. So Arya inevitably translates in the syntax of the human endopsyche, it inevitably translates into a white race supremacist ideology. That is not at all what I mean by Arya, but it is almost impossible to dissociate the word Arya and Aryan from that connotation, isn't it? Too bad. It's terrible. But it goes to show you the degree to which our minds have been perverted by brainwashing of the Zads. The Zads are terrified of Arya and the Aryan ideal, especially as it is represented in the German people. And I can't tell you how much love and admiration I have for the high intellectual, artistic, philosophical, scientific, and spiritual culture of the German people. They are indeed a shining example of Arya, of excellence, as are all the Nordic peoples of Europe in different ways. And so there is such a narrative directed to the destruction of those people who embody and have embodied in historical times in the 20th century the magnificent warrior spirit of Arya. Such a condemning and distorting narrative against them that the word which represents them, the word on their banner, the word that should be displayed beside the symbol of the swastika, well, unfortunately, it's terribly contaminated. So I want to propose that excellence, or arete, is the lightship, is the name of the lightship. Or maybe it's the name of the lightship, and Arya is the name of the light on the ship. And excellence is not contaminated in a similar way as the word Arya, is it? However, what you could say about excellence is it's almost passed away into total oblivion. We have lived almost, I would say, well, certainly the greater part of my lifetime, I've lived in a world that is becoming less and less excellent. You cannot find excellence in hardly anything anymore. There's no excellence in literature, no excellence in dance and the arts, in music, you know, or wherever that excellence is. It's driven into obscurity. It's not allowed to spread and to be received into the hearts and minds of people. But nevertheless, excellence is again a human ideal, a universal or generic human ideal to which we can all aspire. So I would say to all the families of the Anthropos, to all the families of this planet, I would say first, for instance, to my brothers and sisters of color, whether that color be black chocolate black or cafe au lait or all the other beautiful shades of brown and black, I would say to my brothers and sisters, don't get into a turf war with me or anyone else about proving that the origins of civilization and humanity were in Africa. First of all, that's wrong. The origins of civilization, of the human race on this planet and this kalpa and previous kalpas, occurred simultaneously in different parts of the world. There were original races in Australia, in China, in Siberia, and in Africa. So let's not get uppity about that, please. And I call to my colored brothers and sisters, don't show me your superiority based on the claim that Africa is the source of all civilization. I've read Black Athena. I love the book. Everyone should read Black Athena by Martin Bernal. The African Origins of Civilization, I have taken it to my heart, but I don't want to see more division among the ranks of humanity based on that question. Who can claim the origin of civilization? So I say, don't show me your uppity attitude about where civilization began. Show me your excellence now, right now. Show me your excellence without partiality and division. And I say that to the Chinese, I say it to the Australians, I say it to the Native Americans, I say it to the people of every country and culture of this world. I call you all to turn your eyes together, looking as one being, to the lightship. And I call you all to see the name of that mighty vessel, and the name is excellence. Now, to continue with some of the various points in this briefing, I'd like to go back to a reference I made to the book Minerals for the Genetic Code by Charles Walters. Now, you'll know that I referred to that book at the conclusion of the last briefing, What's It to Her? And in that particular instance, I cited one of the 64 tables concerned with the noble gas of argon. Now, you will find, interestingly, in this book, on page 84 and 85, a two-page spread, which is titled the Olree, O-L-R-E-E, Biological Periodic Chart. And what you have there is actually a diagram, it says, copied with permission, copyrighted to Walter Russell in 1926. And any of you who have looked into the work of Walter Russell, particularly his book on light, will be familiar with this design. You will immediately recognize the snake-like image at the center of the design, proceeding from the element of alphanon to the element of tomion, and then describing or showing in the structure of the illustration the various stages or components of the periodic chart of the elements according to Walter Russell. So it appears that the Olree chart and the Russell chart are similar, but Olree expands and amplifies the content of the Russell chart in some manner. Now, I can't say that I have read in depth this book, Minerals of the Genetic Code, so I don't want to recommend to you something that I haven't thoroughly investigated. It's based on the work of Dr. Richard Olree, who was a chiropractic physician, a student of genetics, and author of the Standard Genetic Chart, which appears, as I say, to resemble or be in some ways identical to Walter Russell's chart of the elements. Now, I was quite somewhat careless and quite rapid in citing to you from this chart when I brought up the question of the element of argon. And so I want to just go back and clarify something to you about the way that this book is written. You find entry 44 for argon in the periodic chart on page 128. And the formula or model for each one of the 64 elements is exactly the same. It has a number, in this case 44. It has a Ni Ching trigram or hexagram, excuse me, beside it. So there's a correlation to the I Ching. And then it has 9 or 8 different entries. One of these entries is the element, in this case argon. The element could be cobalt, selenium, bromine, iodine, xenon, and so forth. The association to some other constituent of the chemistry of the human body occupies another slot. So above the slot for argon is arginine, which doesn't appear exclusively in connection with argon, by the way, but it does appear in that one instance. And so you can find, for instance, the metal of, or the element of boron, associated with the physicochemical element of serine. And then there is an association that would only be understood technically by a chiropractor. For instance, entry 31 for boron correlates to serine, the amino acid connected to boron, and it correlates to thoracic 9 disc, and to the heart, to 12 noon, and to the principle of attraction, and so forth. So these are correspondences, as they would traditionally be called in the art and science of alchemy. And I just want to point out, among these correspondences, that the correspondence regarding argon went to lumbar 4 bone, 4 meaning the number 4. So the entry informs you as follows, quote, classical chiropractic conditions of the lumbar 4 areas known to receive nerve fibers from this spinal segment are prostate gland muscles of the lower back and the sciatic nerve, end quote. Now, if any of you have ever studied the structure of the human backbone, perhaps in connection with yogic practices and the ancient technique of Sat Chakra Nirupana, which is raising the thread of Kundalini, or the snake of Kundalini, through the 7 chakras, you will know that the different sections of the human spine can be correlated in different ways. In one respect, they can be correlated to those chakras, which are not physically present in the body, but are energy vortices associated with these regions of the spine, the thoracic section, the lumbar section, and so forth. Correlatively, and what is to me extremely interesting, and Reich himself, Wilhelm Reich, made a deep study of this point, this factor, correlatively, each of those areas of the human spine, obviously of paramount importance to the chiropractor, has a set of nerves running from it. And so the tree of the autonomic nervous system, including the sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves, the tree grows off the spinal column, doesn't it? And so at any particular point, if you locate any particular bone, such as lumbar bone number 4, you will find that the nerve branches that grow off that section of the spinal column feed into certain organs or muscles or areas of the human body. That is exactly what is described in this correlation that I cited in the previous briefing. Okay, so that explains how the Allree chart works, how it is laid out structurally, presenting this highly detailed information. I do, as I say, I can't really unreservedly recommend this book. There are some things in the preface and the introduction that give me some pause, but nevertheless, I think that it contains some really priceless information in this complex set of correlations established by Dr. Allree. So, perhaps this is essential reading for those of you who belong to the school of Euphanes, that is to say, Shodashi, who is the Mahavidya who teaches the beauty of psychic structure, the beauty, balance, and elegance of the psychic structure of the human animal. If you're into that area of study, investigation, and illumination, then you might find this book indispensable. I suggest that you read it side by side with The Function of the Orgasm and The Cancer Biopathy of Wilhelm Reich, which I am currently reading, by the way. I have some things to say about that. Have to stop and make a note here so I don't forget that. Okay, what I want to say to you now, in referring back to Minerals for the Genetic Code, concerns the point I raised in illustration of the Kalika principle that everything is material. Okay? And I pointed out that argon is the evidence in the atmosphere of the Earth of a secretion from the human animal, a thought secretion, due to its mental and cerebral activity, which is also material. It is chemical. It involves neurotransmitters. It occurs in the materiality of the brain. There is no consciousness without matter, and no matter without consciousness. The Kalika principle says that matter and consciousness are coeval and cannot exist independently. They are co-emergent. They arise together and can never be separated. It follows then that there is no such thing as immaterial consciousness. Neither is there any such thing as matter without some kind of consciousness. This is the Kalika view. So I said to you that years ago when I was hanging out by the lotus pool of the world headquarters of the Theosophical Society in Ajar, near Madras, that I came across the notion that human beings secrete into the atmosphere some kind of permanent material essence. But they do it only when their mentation process is engaged in a most intimate and intense way, a most intimate and dynamic way, with the intelligence of the Earth itself. For instance, when you are able to reach with your intellect and your conceptual ability, even momentarily, into the syntax of Sophia's dreaming, you produce then a secretion which she registers in the atmosphere as argon. Argon is to her the proof and evidence that human animals are participating in the syntax of her dreaming. You might recall that I dedicated the talk, the eretic proposition, Nav Briefing number 78, I believe, to this same issue. So, I would like to just mention two other clues in the direction of this bizarre notion. A while ago, I had occasion to look at the film Meetings with Remarkable Men, which you can find on YouTube in 7 or 8 clips. It is, of course, a film by Peter Brook, I believe, a director who also undertook the staging and filming of the Mahabharata, which went on for days. It is a film based on the book of that name by Gurdjieff. And there is an incident in the early part of the film when the young Gurdjieff, no more than a boy of 12, asks his father if consciousness survives after death, so that we would know who we are, or that we would know something. We would have some kind of after-death awareness. And his father pauses and responds thoughtfully. Doing so, his father states in this film, one of the, I would say, 5 signature ideas to be found in the teachings of Gurdjieff. And that idea can be stated in this way. No, consciousness of yourself as you know it does not survive. But a certain substance survives which is immortal. It is not immaterial, but it is an immortal substance. such as we would call the noble gas argon. And according to Gurdjieffian teachings, this immortal substance does not necessarily arise from the life and consciousness of every human animal that lives. Oh no. It only arrives due to the activity and intention exerted by certain human animals while they are living. And so a great part of the Gurdjieff practice was dedicated to the understanding of how to generate this secretion. I don't recall if Gurdjieff gave it a name, but he probably did, because he invented a lot of wild and wacky names, which you can find in Beelzebub's Tales to His Children, one of the great fabulist novels of the 20th century. Now, I would like to say that if you want to go investigate this, go see the film Meetings of Remarkable Men, with Remarkable Men, and watch that passage or incident, which is beautifully acted and presented in the film. As for the rest of the film, I must say it's not at all my cup of tea. I've known a good fair number of Gurdjieffians in my life. I've been drawn or invited into their circles. I never found it attractive. And what you see in this film that rather puts me off, this is just my personal stuff, too many beards and too many men and too much searching for some kind of narcissistic realization of consciousness, which ends up in an extremely mechanical and archontic ritualized practice, that is to say, the Gurdjieff movements. So, as far as I'm concerned, Gurdjieff is an intriguing individual, to say the least. He is spot on in his description of this mysterious secretion, which I now designate to be argon, and was, I can also assure you, that it was most certainly known to the Western alchemists and not merely to the fabulous or fabled Sarmoon Brotherhood described by Gurdjieff. Finally, I just want to say that another clue to this mysterious substance, oh, by the way, if you want to further investigate the notion of the generation of this substance, then you would look into the work of Rodney Collins, Theory of Celestial Influences. I don't propose that you get your head buried in that, but go and take a look at it and sniff it out, and who knows, you may find something to take away from that. Anyway, Rodney Collin, is it Collin or Collins? It's Rodney Collin, 1909 to 1956, a British writer who was deeply involved in the work of P.D. Uspensky and Gurdjieff. Now, the final allusion to this mysterious matter of the argon secretion comes, lo and behold, in the book Minerals of the Genetic Code. Now, I haven't read all 64 entries in the All-Re table, right? The All-Re Standard Genetic Periodic Chart, to give it its full name. But I read the one for argon, and it just so happens that as I was using the book, it fell open to page 156, which contains the entry for Gammonon, number 20. And the amino acid associated with Gammonon is lysine, and the chiropractic index, if you will, is number 4 bone of the thoracic group. And this is what the text says, the short text, regarding Gammonon. Quote, "This is a noble gas. It comes under the guidance of lysine. This subatomic particle has the name, according to Walter Russell, of Gammonon, now called neutrino, and has no electrical charge. The spinal connection is to the thoracic bone 4. Gammonon is one of the most important subatomic particles in the herbs among the DNA sequence. Gammonon is derived from the ratios of the other noble gases. Some investigators believe that the noble gases come into play only under the aegis of thought. End quote. So, to translate, only under the aegis of thought, which is a rather awkward expression, I would make the proposition in this way. Some investigators, such as the Western alchemists, Gurdjieff and his followers, and myself, have stated that the noble gases arise due to the interplay of human thought with the intelligence of the planet. And you can quote me on that. Okay, proceeding now into the second half of this briefing, before we get to the central theme, I want to cover a few more diverse points. What I'd like to say about Fukushima at this point is that the Fukushima event presents the dilemma typical of Kali Yuga, when the work of the archons reaches its consummation. Now recall that famous passage, I think it's in On the Origin of the World, in which the Aeon Sophia declares that at the consummation of their works, the archons shall be defeated by that luminous child, that is to say, by the Anthropos. Now, the conditions of this consummating conflict occur in the Age of Kali, which is now, and in the final moments of the Age of Kali. So it can be said that the archontic problem culminates now. I think that's pretty obvious, isn't it? And one aspect of the archontic problem, my friends, Mimetes, is that you cannot tell truth from lies. In some cases, you certainly can. Don't get me wrong. But in many cases, you cannot tell truth from lies. In many cases, you cannot tell plastic from pearl. Now, you know that the inability to tell plastic from pearl is due to the damage inflicted upon the human mind by the archontic stratagem of simulation. So the archons are continually inducing human animals to produce technologies of simulation which will serve the game of the archons. What is that game? It is namely to trick us to the point where we as human animals can no longer trust our senses and the evidence of our senses, and consequently we cannot tell, as Bob Dylan famously sang, a real blonde from a fake, you know? We cannot tell the difference between a simulated event or object and a real natural event or object produced by the natural processes of the planet. Well, this is the case with Fukushima. You know, I have found an impressive set of documents on the internet which counter the problem of hysteria and false claims regarding radiation coming from Fukushima, Chernobyl, and so forth. But equally so, you can find other documents and other searches that present some evidence to the contrary. Now, when you weigh those two bodies of evidence, when I weigh those two bodies of evidence, I come to the conclusion that the evidence regarding the benevolent and relatively harmless nature of radioactivity as endemic to the planet to be more convincing. but other people would certainly find the evidence to the contrary to me more convincing. So I will only conclude now, I choose to conclude my discussion of Fukushima simply by stating that there is conflicting conclusions based on the evidence. But when I look at the evidence, my own conclusion is that radiation is not what we are told that it is. It is not what we are brainwashed to think. And it is indeed genuinely a part of the transmutational alchemy of the planetary animal mother. I just quote here a beautiful line from a GNE member, Dame Miriam, who writes, "With all the recent discussion on the GNE NBs on radiation and alchemy, I have come to understand more than before that Sophia will not harm her creation and works with Sabaoth and the other planets to protect all of it. She will allow just enough energy in all these forms to transmute us into Anthropos 11 and to bleach out the predators." End quote. She goes on to say, quote, "Sophia creates ways to protect and transmute her creation from the foolishness of human error. She has developed plans to assist in dealing with excess radiation and shows us that she has plans for us that we have only clues to in our first attention." And she provides me with a number of links to plants at Chernobyl and to the actual on-the-ground events that are happening at Chernobyl in consequence to the nuclear industry catastrophe that occurred there. So it's always the same in Kali Yuga, my friend. It's always the same facing the end game of the Archons. The truth must always be based on your own senses and your own assessment of truth. And do not be unduly influenced or intimidated by anybody else's research. Now, I would also advise you to bear in mind, perhaps as a cardinal rule of investigation, something that I have learned to do over the last 4 or 5 years. When I am receiving information through the internet, through a book, or through any other source, but principally through the internet, active today, that is to say, that would be current information in real time. When I am receiving information about anything whatsoever, whether it be radiation at Fukushima or the geopolitical games in the Ukraine, or when I am receiving conclusions of research, put that in quotes, my friends, conclusions of research, charts, the findings of scientists, anything of this sort, I always ask myself this question: what is the agenda of the people who are presenting this information and these conclusions? And unfortunately, and this is a Mephisto game we face all the time, a Mephisto game of occlusion or exclusion or preclusion. What is that Mephisto game specifically? Well, you can listen to people say all kinds of things on the internet, but the one thing they don't tell you is, what is their agenda? You can listen to David Icke. You can listen to F. William Engdahl, who is a masterful geopolitical analyst, or James Corbett of the Corbett Report. You can listen to John Rappaport. You can listen to Jeff Rentz and all the people he has on his show, or Gerald Salentio. You can listen to hundreds of people. And I can tell you right now that I am not like any of those people, because I tell you exactly what my agenda is. And they don't tell you that. And this is extremely unfortunate for both them and the people who are receiving information, commentary, and conclusions from them. It's a Mephisto trick to withhold your agenda. I would say that anyone who withholds their agenda, who is not totally naked and transparent in their agenda, in all aspects, is playing into the hands of Mephisto, and in some way or another is accessory to the Mephisto game. And the Mephisto game is a game that consummates the self-delusion and self-deceit of the human animal. And it is unfortunate that so many people play into that game by the very fact that they omit to let you know what their agenda is. Because only when you know the agenda of someone who is giving you information can you fully and accurately evaluate that information. Isn't that logical? Okay, on final note on the notion of radiation and Fukushima. I haven't read a book in quite a long time. It's difficult for me to read anymore, more than a few pages. But about a month ago, or since, actually more recently, since I last talked to you, I ordered The Cancer Biopathy by Wilhelm Reich. Now, that's not a very attractive title. I mean, you know, he wrote a book called The Function of the Orgasm. I mean, come on, folks. Let's face it. Is that an attractive title? Very attractive title. So you all crew members, you know, are encouraged and invited to read The Function of the Orgasm by Wilhelm Reich. It's absolutely wonderful and illuminating book. And absolutely an essential reading to every sane, for the sanity of every human animal. But Wright considered that The Cancer Biopathy was the companion book to The Function of the Orgasm. And so I've decided, you know, I finally have to read The Cancer Biopathy, because it is the one main work of Reich that I had not read. I've read Ether, God, and Devil, Cosmic Superimposition, The Mass Psychology of Fascism, The Murder of Christ, The Sexual Revolution, Character Analysis, and The Function of the Orgasm. But I had not read The Cancer Biopathy, so I'm reading it now, and I have to tell you, it's difficult, because it's very technical. It goes into his technical laboratory clinical studies, which are absolutely fascinating. I'm sure they're incomparable. No one else has ever made any studies, had ever made any such studies, up until the time that Reich did, working between the two wars. Nor has anyone since carried forward these extremely illuminating and profoundly important studies of the nature of life at the border, studies of the nature of organic life at the border of inorganic life. And so I have learned, I am learning, I am attempting to learn, what is actually a bion. Now, you all have to agree that it would be a really good idea if I knew what a fracking bion is, you know? Because, actually, to speak in Reichian lingo, fucking bion is a lot more accurate, okay? You say fracking when you want to condemn something. You say fucking when you want to compliment it. So, do you have any idea what a fucking bion is? I don't. It's a difficult concept to grasp. But it appears to be, lo and behold, a form of Gaian life activity that lies on the border between the inorganic and the organic dimension, which, if I may say so, very much appears to be the case for radioactivity, isn't it? What would you say for radioactivity? Well, it is not an emission of organic life, like sweat or the breath of animals or any other secretions or emanations or energetic emissions that come from the organic world, but the inorganic world of the planetary animal mother is also totally alive and conscious in its own way. Everything is material. And it appears that bions operate on this borderline. There is a liminal activity of bions. So I have said that radioactivity is the evidence of bionic excitation that occurs in the presence of transmutational alchemy performed by the first detention of the Aeon Sophia. Now that's a pretty ornate and arcane and beautiful and tempting and delicious proposition. And having made that proposition, I certainly deem it fitting that I would know what a bion is. But I have to tell you that I'm just beginning to learn by reading this book. Okay, so this is where it gets exciting. The very beginning of the cancer biopathy, in the chapter called The Function of Tension and Charge, Reich is talking about his findings derived from bioelectrical experiments between 1934 and 1936. Now, as I read these sentences, I want you to bear in mind that we today are living in a world where technology immerses the human animal in a massive field of electrical and radio vibrations and frequencies. Bear that in mind. Bear in mind that we are all immersed in that field. For instance, the shortwave frequencies of cell phone towers, and also the electrical frequencies emanated from high tension wires and so forth, and many other sources of electricity, man-made electricity, right? This is what he says. Quote, our sense organs completely fail to register the effect of the electromagnetic waves that fill the atmosphere. In proximity to a radio transmitter, we feel nothing. A radio reacts when near a high tension wire. We do not. If our life energy, which is expressed in our organ sensations, were electricity, it would be incomprehensible that we should perceive only the wavelengths of visible light and otherwise remain totally insensitive. We perceive neither the electrons of an X-ray machine nor the radiation from radium. Electrical energy does not convey a biological charge. Thus far, it has not been possible to determine the potency of vitamins with electrical measurements, even though they doubtless contain biological energy. The examples could be continued indefinitely. Another problem is how our organism keeps itself from being destroyed by the infinite number of electromagnetic fields surrounding it. End quote. Now, it's certainly true that some people today who have experimented with so-called bioelectricity or with the responsivity of the human body to the electromagnetism of the planet would refute these findings of Reich, and they might argue that Reich was mistaken or that his findings were not complete or that they were read in a way that misled him. But what I find really remarkable is the conclusion that Reich drew from these investigations between 1934 and 1936. In fact, he made a kind of claim based on those conclusions. This is the way of science. They study, they draw conclusions, and then scientists make a claim or statement based on their research. This is a claim that Reich made. Unfortunately, I can't find the exact sentence in which he states it, but I'll give you a close paraphrase. Research in bioelectricity shows that the electrical properties of the human organism, which are undeniable and can be measured, are not mere effects of its immersion in the electromagnetic field of the planet. But they arise independently from the living plasm of the human animal. So Reich uses this term, living plasm or germplasm. Cytoplasm used to be the technical term. The Anthropos genome is material. It's a calibrated cytoplasm. Okay? So what Reich is saying, to put it fast and simple, is that there are electrical and magnetic properties in the cytoplasm of the human animal which cannot be reduced to the electromagnetic properties of the planet. Although the human animal does in some ways interact, of course, with the electromagnetic properties of the planet, electricity as such cannot be the electricity of external nature, such as the electricity running these machines I'm using, is not the same as the bioelectricity of the human organism. Now, as far as what I can understand, Reich's studies of the bion at the borderline between inorganic and organic life convinced him of this difference. He might have been wrong, but if he was right, it's a staggering discovery. I mean, I had never really thought about it before in such an intricate way, you know. I had never really occurred to me, since we as human animals are immersed in the body of the planetary animal mother, it had never occurred to me that we in our cytoplasmic composition might have bioelectrical properties operating, for instance, in the DNA and through the cells of our body, that actually operates on its own terms, is not merely a reflex to the bioelectrical magnetism of the Earth. Well, that suggests a picture to me, a picture not of the combined sperm and ovum deposited in the wall of the uterus, but rather of the anthropic plasm deposited in the atmosphere of the Earth. Now, if the Earth were a planet that was not imminently penetrated by an ionic being, and there are many planets who are not, then the Earth would merely be another planetary laboratory in the galactic arms that is chemically able to support and foster life. So the germplasm, such as that of the Anthropos, would be deposited in such a planetary setting, and it would find a suitable habitat to develop. It would be like a virus deposited in the culture of a petri dish. In that instance, were the planet not indwelt by an ionic being, the material of the petri dish would simply be the inert holder of the life form, the life plasm, deposited in it. But in our case, both the life plasm or germ of the Anthropos that is deposited and the atmospheric medium in which it is deposited are alive, organically alive. So, the anthropic plasm from Orion is deposited in an organically a live medium, which has electromagnetic properties. That's the atmosphere of the Earth, including, of course, the telluric currents coming from the material body of the Earth. That situation is quite different from what it would have been if the anthropic germplasm was merely deposited in an atmosphere that was inorganically alive. See the difference? Well, Reich's studies in the 30s between the two wars took place exactly at that boundary. And he describes the bion as a form that arises in the boundary zone between inorganic chemistry and organic chemistry. So he made a tremendous discovery, which, had it been pursued, would have led to the deepest and most intimate revelations of how human life functions on this planet. But, of course, as we know, Reich was not allowed to continue those studies. He was murdered by the authorities, the feds in the United States, the FDA, in the 50s, and his works were destroyed, his laboratory equipment was destroyed, and a great deal of the original records of the laboratory research he pursued was also destroyed. So Reich was consummately the modern Gnostic scientist who penetrated into the secrets of the biosphere. And it is really amazing to go and read the Cancer Biopathy. And I'm going to continue to read it closely and reread it as correction gets underway. I would guess that my best chance to, you know, stand by what I said about, quote, bionic excitation and radiation comes from reading this book and arriving at some insights based on Reich's amazing and groundbreaking research. So that's about all I can say right now about what I'm learning by reading the Cancer Biopathy. So now, to conclude this briefing, let me tell you that the 3 years of doing the GNE stands unique in my experience. It is the most ambitious and daring teaching exercise that I've ever undertaken, by far. And I can tell you, without reservation, that doing this experiment with you has brought me to the absolute limit of my capacities as a mythologist and even as an Ahual. What I have been able to tell you through the exercise of my second attention is all I can tell you. I can't tell you any more than I've told you in these briefings. And so I won't be able to decode, elucidate, and explain by the time of the final briefing certain mythological factors of the GNE. Those include, of course, the story of Mantis, the story of Mephisto, story of Melchizedek. I don't know why all these M's keep coming up. But in particular, I want to advise you about the Perseus myth, which may also be called the Kali-Kalki scenario. I want to advise you that the Perseus myth, you can see the Perseus myth displayed in the constellations in a vast tableau. There is Andromeda, the woman chained to the rock. Above her is Cassiopeia, her mother, and Cepheus, her father, these are celestial royalty in the heavens. To the left or east of the long V-shape of the Andromeda constellation is the constellation of Perseus. To her right is the constellation of Pegasus, depicted in such a way that the winged horse of Pegasus springs from her forehead, marked by the star Alpheratz. So you have Andromeda with Perseus on the left, Pegasus on the right, and then below Pegasus you have the constellation of the Manitou. To the left of that, the fishes, one of which leaps up toward Andromeda. And then below the constellation of the fishes, and extending toward the ram, you have the constellation of Cetus. Remember that Cetus is the aromatic monster that threatens to devour Andromeda, who is chained to a rock due to a boastful statement made by her mother Cassiopeia, while her father Cepheus sort of stood aside in detachment with no comment and no involvement. And in the completion or resolution of that myth, Perseus, whose name means the destroyer, uses certain magical tools provided to him by the gods, in order to rescue Andromeda. One of those tools is the shield of Athena, which is like a mirror. By looking into the mirror of Athena's shield, he is able to not look directly at the Medusa, and therefore sever the head of the Medusa, which has a paralyzing force, exactly the way that inorganic electricity paralyzes you. So if you're having a bath and your hair dryer falls into the water, you will be paralyzed as if before the gaze of the Medusa, won't you? Perseus then takes the head of the Medusa, which he does not look at ever directly, hence the device of Athena's mirror shield, and holds it up to Cetus, the sea monster, therefore paralyzing Cetus, preventing Cetus from devouring Andromeda. And so Perseus rescues Andromeda. Now this is a massive, massive celestial tableau. And obviously, it is a massively complex myth. Now, I want to advise you that I am not able, in the remainder of the GNE talks, to decode this myth adequately or completely for you. So you're going to be going into correction with me without this myth having been fully elucidated. We know that this is the one myth above all others that we would wish to understand for the purposes of succeeding in our participation in correction, right? We know that, right? How do we know that? Because I have said that the Perseus myth is a memory of the Andromedan view of Sophia's intercession into the experiment of Anthropos 10. Perseus becomes Kali Kalki, or the Kali Avatar. We now understand the Kali Avatar to be the Tulpa of the Aeon Sophia. Okay? So, this is a massive, massive mythological complex that I cannot resolve and that I cannot elucidate. I am at the limit of my powers. It is beyond my powers to say anything more about this than I have said already. So I want you to know that you and I are going to go into correction together, myself and all of you, I should say, more correctly, are going into correction together a week from the time that I'm making this talk. and you dedicated sailors in the GNE are going to carry into correction some unfinished and unresolved elements of this experiment, and that's okay. They will come to be revealed in correction. Not everything could be revealed in reset. Simply because we as human animals do not have the capacity of the first and second attention required for such a total and comprehensive elucidation. So it's okay. It's all right that there are unfinished and unresolved themes and that there are threads left hanging. Now, we come to the central message of this briefing at 1 hour and 10 minutes. The central message is stated in the title of this briefing, The Advantage Given to Truth. What is the advantage given to truth? What does this phrase mean? Well, I propose to you that this is the phrase we all use in the shift from reset to correction, to focus together as a team, as a crew, to focus together in our witnessing of correction, so that we are always all on the same page in correction. Now, there are going to be many different directions to look in correction. Remember, I'm in the process of defining the ranks of the Calico War Party. There are 16 ranks, and each of those ranks has a specific position to hold existentially, morally, creatively, intellectually, socially, positions of social activism in correction. There are many directions to look in correction, and there are unfinished themes coming out of the GNE itself. Well, that being so, my friends, it is imperative that we can concentrate and unite our minds and hearts on one single unifying theme, the advantage given to truth. You may discover many wonderful things in correction. You may discover the fulfillment and completion and manifestation of topics and themes that I have articulated through these briefings. And you may even discover new topics and themes that will emerge for you within your lives, within the scope of your imaginations, in the combination of the first and second attentions. And as you advance to a recognition of what is the third attention, the vista of learning and realization ahead of us is immense. But it would be possible, there is a risk, I should say, that we would become distracted, that we would become overwhelmed by the abundance and diversity of the changes that can occur in correction. So I advise to you, in the final moments of this briefing, that we all concentrate on one possibility, that is the ultimate prospect of correction. By ultimate prospect, I mean simply that single paramount factor that would ensure that correction succeeds, both on her terms, for which the perfect initial conditions have been set, and on our terms, extending to every aspect of personal, social, and planetary experience. That is the great prospect. I mean to say that we can all focus on this single and paramount truth. For correction to succeed, the advantage in all human affairs must be given to truth and taken away from deceit and duplicity. One of the statements that has now become common on the internet among those who are opposed to the way the world operates, those who see its corruption, those who see the destructive agenda that is being enforced. One of the most common statements made among those people is that the game is rigged, the system is rigged. Everything in human reality, in human social reality, is rigged to the advantage of duplicity. That is to say, rigged by the perpetrators and psychopaths to their advantage. So, what conclusion can you draw from that? Well, if correction is to succeed and make a real difference in our world, that is to say, the betterment and improvement of human affairs, then the rigging of the game to the advantage of deceit and duplicity must give way to the advantage on the side of truth. Until now, exposing the truth has only had a minor and relative impact, if any, upon the nefarious orchestrations of social evil conducted by the psychopaths, including the executive branch of the ZADs. Only a minor, precarious, and superficial effect. Why? Because exposing the truth about the way the world operates is not enough to change the way it operates. And why not? Because the advantage stands on the side of those who use deceit and duplicity to manipulate human life. And as long as the advantage is given to duplicity, truth, no matter how brilliant or shocking, truth alone will not change the situation on this planet. So, we know about the challenge to bring a countermanding truth into the world, don't we? That is what is going to change the advantage and give the advantage to truth. So you need to concentrate on that question. How to bring a countermanding truth to the lie and duplicity of the world in every and any single instance of your personal reality. It's all upfront and personal. It's all existential and immediate. But additional to that, let's all of us consider this. How would we know if the game changed, and if the rigging of the game to the advantage of the predators gave way to a different proportion of odds, if the odds changed in favor of truth, that it would truly become a force that can make change? Because as it is now, you must honestly admit that truth alone is not a force that can bring change. Not the kind we need at this final moment in this desperate situation. So I put it to you to consider that we all focus on this question. We all ask ourselves every day in correction, how do I see the advantage going to truth? And how can I act accordingly and appropriately as it does so? No matter what may happen in correction, no matter the many and diverse changes that may occur for the better, for the rectification of human society, Everything that can happen in that way must be based on the advantage of the game going to truth. That is what you want to look for. That is the direction we are all going to look as we move from reset into correction.